This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
In this weekend episode, three segments from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on the aftermath of this week's midterm elections. First, on this Veterans Day weekend, Leo Shane, deputy editor of the Military Times, discusses how veterans running for office this cycle fared and key military and veterans issues in Congress. Then Stephen Fowler, political reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting, previews the December 6th runoff election in the Senate race there between incumbent Senator Democrat Raphael Warnock and his Republican challenger Herschel Walker. Plus Heritage Foundation's Hans von Spakovsky and Sean Morales Doyle of the Brennan Center for Justice on how the midterm elections were conducted, the first since January 6th, and if Americans' confidence in elections has been restored. First, Leo Shane of the Military Times.
Leo Shane, how many veterans were running this cycle?
Yeah, we had almost 200 veterans running this cycle, which is the largest field we've seen since 2012 in a decade. So it really shows that some of these younger veterans are starting to come into politics, work their way up through some state races, some local races, and start to put an impact on the national scene.
What issues were they running on?
You know, it's funny. This is a big part of their campaign. This is a big part of their identity. But it's not, veterans don't usually run on that many veterans issues or military issues. It's another line in their resume. So we did see quite a few campaigns that mentioned concerns about VA care, about VA access, the PACT Act, which I know you guys covered a lot over the summer. This is the toxic exposure legislation. That was a key point in a lot of the campaign materials. But for the most part, you know, they're running on the economy. They're running on public safety. They're running on the same issues we're seeing other candidates run on. It's just a matter of getting to tell people, look, I also serve. That's another experience line. It's another resume line for me that shows I'm qualified to be in office.
How many of those running won their seats?
As of right now, you said there's still a bunch we don't know, but as of right now, we're looking at 94 veterans in Congress at the start of next year. So that would be the biggest we've seen since 2017. The first time we've seen a substantial increase in veterans since 2017 as well. So, you know, good sign that some of these messages are resonating and that this younger generation of veterans, the Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans, are really starting to come into their own and take a position in Congress with their issues and with their experience.
Is that 94 total, including incumbents, or is that just 94 new members who are veterans?
Yeah, that is 94 total. That is 94 incumbents and new veterans and sitting members of the Senate who didn't have races this year. So it's not a huge number. I mean, it's a good portion of what Congress is, but that number was as high as 200 in the mid-90s. The number was up above 400 in the 1970s. And that's really just a reflection of some of the demographics of veterans in our society. Before the all-volunteer military in the 1970s, you know, almost 75% of Congress was a veteran, had served in the military at some point. As we shifted away from that, as a smaller portion of America has served and has lived the military life, we've just seen those numbers slowly drift down.
And you've seen a diversification of Congress, too. You've seen more women elected since those years, et cetera.
And this is going to be the largest class of women veterans we've ever had in Congress. It's only 7, but it's been a steady uptick in recent years. You know, I believe we have 5 incumbents, 3 who just won re-election, and then 2 new female veterans who will be coming in. More female Republicans than we've ever had before. So, you know, those are, again, more viewpoints that we haven't seen in the past. It's always been sort of male veterans, male military experience. Now we're seeing the women come in and also share their experience of moving into some of those combat jobs that used to be closed, talking about issues like sexual harassment and sexual assault, and just talking about what it's like to be a woman in the military and how to recruit, how to retain those individuals.
So how many of those running and won are Democrats versus Republicans? How does it break down along party lines?
Yeah, it's pretty tilted towards the Republican side. It's almost a 2-to-1 ratio at the moment. But, there are still a few races outstanding. And that's on par with what we've seen for most years, too. There are more Republican veteran candidates than Democrats. So I didn't get the last count last night, but it's somewhere around 25, 26 of those, I believe, are Democrats. The rest are Republicans. It's interesting. One of the selling points for veterans on the campaign trail and selling points among the veterans advocates who are pushing for more veterans in Congress is that the party labels shouldn't matter as much. These are folks who have worked on a mission, haven't asked what your party affiliation is, can sort of put their heads down and just get the work done. We've seen that anecdotally with some members, but we've also seen some of the polarization of Congress play in there too. So we know that quite a few of the Republicans who ran this year were folks who questioned the election results from 2020. 55% of the veterans who ran said either voted against certification of the election or had public statements on the campaign trail questioning Biden's legitimacy. So being a veteran doesn't isolate you from all of those political whims, but the hope is that there's some common ground on military issues, on veterans issues, and on some just, unity of America issues that these veterans will be able to work together when they get into Congress to find some sort of joint answer or common ground.
And what are some of the pressing issues impacting veterans that Congress needs to deal with when they come back, to finish out this term, but also the new Congress, the 118th Congress?
Yeah. Big one this term is going to be finishing up the defense budget and the veterans budget, along with the rest of the federal budget. So that'll be a fun fight, especially if there's going to be a changeover in power of House and power of the Senate. Will Republican-controlled chambers want to make any decisions now until, before they have the control of the agenda next year? The big veterans issue that we're going to be watching, again, is that PACT Act. So this passed last summer. This is $300 billion in spending. It could impact as many as one in every five veterans in America. The implementation of that really starts in January. We've seen some smaller portions, some screening of veterans for toxic exposure injuries, opening of some healthcare issues. That's happened the last few months, but we're going to see tens of thousands of new disability claims hit VA starting in January, and they're going to need to start working through that, start awarding these claims. So oversight of that, real scrutiny of whether or not VA is executing their new authorities right, whether or not they're getting veterans claims done in a timely manner. That's going to be the focus of lawmakers when they get back.
That was Leo Shane, deputy editor of the Military Times.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Next, a preview of Georgia's Senate runoff election, which could decide the balance of power in the Senate.
We're joined by Stephen Fowler, political reporter with Georgia Public Broadcasting, joining us via Zoom. Stephen Fowler, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
So walk us through what a runoff means and how this is going to work. Is there mail-in voting? Is there early voting? Is this going to be an election just like what we saw on Tuesday, just happening in December?
Well, first off, Georgia is only one of two states that does runoffs like this, both for primary and general election. That means since nobody received more than 50% plus one vote, we have the top two vote getters, in this case, Democrat Raphael Warnock and Republican Herschel Walker, go to a runoff. Now, Georgia's massive voting law change that took place in 2021 means that the runoff timeline is now 4 weeks after the election instead of nine. And that takes everything we typically see with an election, whether it's voting by mail or voting early in person, and supercharges and compresses the timeline. Because the runoff election can't technically start until elections officials finish this election, the certification process for this election isn't going to be finished until around Thanksgiving, even though we already know there's going to be a runoff. So in-person early voting can't start until the Saturday after Thanksgiving. There's going to be at minimum 1 week of in-person early voting, a Monday to Friday, instead of 3 weeks during a general election. And then absentee by mail ballots will also have a tighter turnaround. The law says as soon as possible, but there are most of the people that requested mail-in ballots are people that are over 65, disabled, or have another reason where they can get a ballot mailed to them every election and an election cycle. So the short, well, that's the long answer, but the short answer is that it's a typical election, basically just pumped up on steroids, super fast, and as a result, probably going to have a little bit lower turnout.
And what are the folks who oversee elections in Georgia saying about the ability to meet that supercharged timeline that you just went through?
Well, the elections officials here in Georgia have been through a lot since 2020. At the beginning of 2020, before the pandemic took hold, they rolled out the country's largest ever implementation of a new voting system. They were trained on that. There was the election with the pandemic, record mail-in voting. So the people that work the polls and run elections and get people trained have gone through a lot. They're prepared for this. The law changing it to 4 weeks was passed back in 2021, so there's time to implement it. But another thing that we have to consider here in Georgia is that in a general election now, we have to do what's known as a risk-limiting audit, meaning that the Secretary of State actually today is going to announce one statewide race where elections officials next week are going to use a statistical model to pull random batches of votes from different counties and different voting methods across the state and hand count those and ensure that the results are accurate and not in the sense that, well, it was 50 the first time and it's 49 the second time, but rather that the right winner won. So in this case, if they were to pick Georgia's governor's race, they would do these random batches of votes, not all 4 million. And if Brian Kemp had more votes than Stacey Abrams, then that audit satisfies their needs. And so elections officials are tired. They're optimistic they can get this done, and they're really going the extra mile to make sure that voters have a good, safe experience.
Remind us what the reason was to go from 9 weeks for a runoff to 4 weeks.
Well, the Republican-led legislature decided that. Georgia actually used to have four-week runoffs a while back. One of the reasons that it went to nine is because there's a federal law for military and overseas voters that extends a certain amount of time they have to receive their ballots for federal elections. But Georgia got around that, so to speak, by sending those military and overseas voters a ranked choice instant runoff ballot. So military and overseas voters in Georgia that voted in this general election sent back two ballots. One, their general election choices, Herschel Walker, Raphael Warnock, so on. But the second ones will be opened in the runoff, and they had to rank their choices. If they voted for the Libertarian the first time, the Libertarian's not on the runoff. So their second choice, whether it's the Republican or the Democrat or leaving it blank, will be what's counted. So it's a way to still have those voters have their votes count, but not have to have the extended timeline. And so there has been some discussion about the legislature maybe extending the timeline a little further. We'll see how this 4 weeks goes. But, you know, the Thanksgiving holiday does tend to interfere with county offices being closed and voters being out of town and campaigns really not trying to bombard people with a big rally while everybody's sitting at the dinner table.
You mentioned the Libertarian. Chase Oliver is the Libertarian, garnering about 2% of the vote in the Senate race. Where is it expected that his voters go?
Well, there are some people that vote for the Libertarian candidate because they prefer the Libertarian candidate. It's unclear whether those people will support Herschel Walker or Raphael Warnock or just not vote. Now, the reason Chase Oliver got about 2% in this election is there is a sizable number of Republican voters in Georgia that do not want to vote for Herschel Walker. They do not like him. They do not think he's fit to be a senator, but they will not vote for Raphael Warnock. And so we saw with the pre-election polling, a considerable number of Republicans saying they would launch a protest vote for Chase Oliver. So those voters, they might just stay home. They might vote for Warnock. But it's very unlikely that many of those voters go back to Herschel Walker because basically not voting for Walker was the primary reason they chose to cast that ballot. And in the governor's race, Brian Kemp received about 53% of the vote. Herschel Walker finished about 5% behind that, meaning that really 1 in 10 Republican voters in Georgia said that they were going to vote for anyone but Herschel Walker. That's a considerable amount, and why we're in this runoff situation.
And then the question about spending and more ads on Georgia voters TV. Do we have a sense of how much was spent in the general election so far and how much more is likely to be spent over the next 4 weeks?
Oh, I mean, it's a good day to be a television station owner in Georgia. I'll tell you that much, because hundreds of millions of dollars between the campaigns, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, the Senate Majority Project, and all of these outside groups. Really, Georgia has been blanketed with ads and mailers and surrogates and everything really for almost the past 4 years, because it's become such a battleground state. And we've seen early reporting so far that Republicans are doing whatever it takes to pour the money in to get Herschel Walker elected. There's also, I saw on Twitter last night, Senator John Ossoff from Georgia was rallying other senators to share fundraising links to check in and have people raise money for Warnock. And so the fact that Georgia has this runoff in December and once again has a Senate race undecided while everybody else should have the answers means you've got an outsized money, outsized attention, and really just outsized pressure on these campaigns to deliver votes for their respective sides.
How did these campaigns plan to spend their time over the next 4 weeks? And is there any chance there might be another debate here before the runoff?
Well, we're already seeing campaigning happening. I mean, the dust is not even settled. The election's not even certified. It's still election week. And already Herschel Walker is campaigning with Texas Senator Ted Cruz this afternoon in a Republican exurb that would be a key part of him winning the runoff. And so we're already seeing campaign events happen. Strategists and operatives barely had, 15 minutes to rest before getting back to work. We've seen a massive ground game in Georgia on the Republican side, spearheaded by Governor Brian Kemp, who's kind of stepped in place of the state party. And that activation will probably happen on the Democratic side since Stacey Abrams lost the governor's race. She's got a lot of time on her hands, and she's got a lot of dedicated supporters and followers and grassroots organizers that will stay ready for Raphael Warnock. So we're already seeing the campaigning happen. It wouldn't be surprised if you see new ads rolling out soon. As far as the debate, that seems unlikely. There was a large saga over the summer of Raphael Warnock accepting 3 different debates, one in Atlanta, one in Macon, one in Savannah. Herschel Walker not accepting those, then proposing his own 4th debate, and Warnock eventually agreeing to that. So with this tight timeline and with really the reaction that the debate had for both candidates, Herschel Walker touted his debate and said it was a victory and it helped him. Warnock said it helped show how Walker was out of touch and not ready. But I mean, that's valuable time and energy not spent getting out the vote, not spent rallying. And I think it would be a very long shot to see a debate, though in Georgia, anything's possible.
That was Stephen Fowler, who covers politics for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Next, we'll hear from Hans von Spakovsky from the Heritage Foundation and Sean Morales Doyle of the Brennan Center for Justice on Americans' faith in democracy and elections.
We are talking about election integrity in these midterm elections that just happened earlier this week. And joining us for the conversation this morning is Hans von Spakovsky, who's initiative manager and senior legal fellow with the Heritage Foundation. He works on election law reform. He was also a GOP member of the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity, appointed by President Trump in 2017 to 2018. Also joining us this morning from New York is Sean Morales Doyle. He's the Voting Rights Program Director with the Brennan Center for Justice. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here. Let me begin with this New York Times headline. After election, cautious optimism that few false narratives took hold. Sean Morales Doyle, let me go to you first. Do you agree with that headline?
I think I do agree with that headline. I think, there were some folks running on in some of the states this year that denied the outcome of the last presidential election. And so there was a lot of concern that if they lost this year, they might deny the outcome of their own elections. And so far, we haven't seen a whole lot of that. Some of those folks lost, some of them won, but We didn't see a lot of lies being told about the way that our elections worked. And largely, election administration on election day this year went pretty well. There were certainly some hiccups. There were certainly some things that could have been done better. And there are certainly some underlying problems in the way that our democracy works. But on election day this year, things were administered pretty smoothly. And it doesn't seem like a whole lot of the lies that we heard from last election have taken hold so far this time around.
Hans von Spakovsky, would you agree with that New York Times headline?
Well, what I would say is that many states improved their election procedures since the 2020 election. That was kind of a wake-up call for a lot of states, and places like Florida, Georgia, Texas, and many other states actually passed good improvements to their laws, and I think we saw the effects of that in this election. I mean, that was a good thing. I think confidence actually was higher of the public. That's a crucial thing. We want to maintain public confidence in the election process, and I think many of those reforms helped maintain that kind of confidence in the elections.
What were some of the reforms that you think helped?
Well, in Georgia, for example, and Texas also, they extended their voter ID laws, which have been in place for a number of years with no problems, to absentee ballots. And that's obviously important because so many more people today are voting through the mail, through the absentee balloting process. And that, in fact, was a good improvement. Georgia, with those reforms, has seen record turnout. I mean, some of the last data that the Secretary of State released just before the election showed that early voting and absentee voting was approaching presidential election year levels. That is unprecedented for a congressional election.
Sean Morales Doyle, do you agree that these are improvements?
No, I don't. I actually don't think that, for instance, while I agree that election administration went smoothly, I don't think that the reforms that Mr. von Spakovsky is referring to are responsible for it. Putting an additional hurdle in front of a voter, like requiring them to put ID numbers on a mail ballot, does not make things run smoother on election day. To the contrary, that rule he's talking about in Texas, in the March primary, there were tens of thousands of absentee ballots rejected as a result of that rule. And in fact, they were disproportionately the ballots of non-white voters. One out of every five Asian American voters in Texas in the March primary that tried to vote by mail had either their application or the ballot rejected. That's not making things run smoother. That's disenfranchising people. The way that that rule worked was that if I put down my driver's license number on my application, but it turns out that my Social Security number is the one in my registration record, my application is going to be rejected. And the same is true vice versa. Or if when I applied, I didn't have either of those things in my voter registration record, then it doesn't matter what number I put down, my application is going to get rejected. I don't think that helps does anything for election integrity. What it does is disenfranchise voters. And while I agree that turnout was quite high in this election, including in Georgia, we didn't quite hit 2018 levels, but we were up there, it seems. Turnout does not tell the whole story. What we know from Georgia specifically is that while turnout has been going up, the racial turnout gap, the gap between white voters and non-white voters, is actually growing. In the Georgia primary this year, we saw the largest gap between white and black voters that we've seen in a decade's worth of primaries. So I think if we scratch a little bit below the surface of that turnout, the question we should really be asking ourselves is, what could have turnout looked like if we weren't putting these obstacles in front of voters, rather than assuming that because there's high turnout, these policies aren't having any kind of impact on voters?
Your response.
A lot of that is just not true. Georgia's had a voter ID law in place since 2008. And in fact, these very same claims were made way back then that this would keep black residents of the state from voting. In fact, the state has seen record registration numbers and record turnout numbers by black voters since that ID law went in place. Not only that, but it's very clear that the American people don't agree with that sentiment. The polling shows that an overwhelming majority of Americans, for example, believe that an ID requirement is just a common sense requirement that we should have. And that is a majority of Democrats, a majority Republicans, independents, and a majority of African Americans, whites, Hispanics, doesn't matter what. This is one of the few issues in a sharply divided nation that folks actually agree on, no matter what their political affiliations or what their race or ethnic background.
That was Hans von Spakovsky from the Heritage Foundation and Sean Morales Doyle of the Brennan Center for Justice. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, and on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.